Welcome to this podcast from the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, exploring aspects of our life and witness at this time.
So hello and welcome to episode 73 of the PCI podcast. Wherever you are or however you're listening to us, it's great to have you with us. Over the past few weeks, there's been much focus on the 25th anniversary of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement. We're calling this episode The Unfinished Work of Peace, 25 years on from the Good Friday Agreement. We'll be taking some time to explore PCI's role in peace and reconciliation and whether peacemaking is still part of the mandate of the church today. I'm Karen Jardine, PCI's Public Affairs Officer, and I'm hosting our conversation today. And I'm delighted to be joined by Reverend Dr. Tony Davidson, Reverend Dr. Marty McNeely, and Jack McQuillan. So folks, it's really wonderful to have you on the podcast. And as we begin, I wonder if in 30 seconds, you could tell us who you are, where you're from, what you do, and maybe what you were doing 25 years ago. So we'll go Marty, Tony, and then Jack.
Thanks, Karen. Good to be here. I am currently the Minister of Ballochale Presbyterian Church in Ballymena. I've been here 15 and a half years. 25 years ago, I was driving a van for a courier. I was about to start work in a communications office in Church House, the PCI. I had recently come to faith. I had recently graduated with a degree in politics at the University of Ulster, or Ulster University, as it's now called. I was member of White Abbey Presbyterian Church, and the current clerk, Reverend Trevor Gribben, was the minister, and I'd got engaged to my then girlfriend, now wife, Julie, and I was playing junior rugby at North of Ireland Rugby Club.
Thanks, Tony.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here. I'm Tony Davidson. I'm a retired Presbyterian minister, now living in Dungannon, where I grew up. But for 28 years, I was the minister in First Armagh. So 25 years ago, I was in the middle of a Bible study, which was organised by ACONA, Evangelical Contribution on Northern Ireland. And it was a series called Journey and Understanding. And would you believe it happened to be running between the Good Friday Agreement and the referendum. So we had very good speakers. We pored over the Bible for those weeks, wondering what we should do. There was one particular speaker who wasn't able to turn up. It turned out that he was briefing the Prime Minister at the time and didn't come to our small meeting in Armagh.
Great, thanks. And what about you, Jack?
Yeah, I'm Jack. I'm a student at Queen's studying politics and international relations. And then I'm a member in Ebrington Presbyterian up in Derry. And 25 years ago, well, I didn't exist yet. Wasn't born. I was born August 2001. So what's the term? Is it a peace baby? So I guess, I was a peace baby. And yeah, so my experience of the Good Friday Agreement very much just comes from the stories from my mum and dad around the time. And yeah, well, what they thought about the whole thing going down.
Great, thanks, Jack. Tony, one of your roles is convener of the Peace and Reconciliation Panel, which sits under the Council of Public Affairs. Is peacemaking part of Christian discipleship today? And if so, why is it important?
Well, I think there's a direct biblical imperative. Blessed are the peacemakers. We're told to forgive our enemies. But there's also a context in Northern Ireland that makes that even more important. I suppose I would tell the story of way back in the 80s, the middle of the Troubles, my wife-to-be was working in Sheffield in a church. And I remember being there and the rector called me over. He was having a conversation with somebody and he said, I think you need to answer this. And the guy said, I don't want to be a Christian because I see what's happening in Northern Ireland. Now, my politics wasn't able to stretch to explain to him all the intricate details of what was going on there. But obviously, there was a problem that in terms of how we were perceived outside of Northern Ireland, there was a problem for our witness. And it occurred to me that we could turn that around by showing, by bringing glory to God, by making peace in Northern Ireland. So instead of it being a place that people looked at and said, no, I don't want to be a Christian, people would look and say, yes, I do want to be a Christian, because these are people who know in Christ's name how to make peace.
And Marty, what does that look like at the level of an individual congregation?
I think for us, praying for peace, preaching within the context of the sovereignty of God, that salvation is not just for an individual, but grace is for the whole of society. And we pray that the kingdom will come on earth as it is in heaven. And, you know, practically, you know, that means we recognize that all people are made in the image of God, whether they're serving police officers right through to people with paramilitary backgrounds or, you know, people with a past or currently engaged in community work. We want to try and affirm the culture, respect other cultures, engage your own members to serve the community and recognize they're part of a wider denomination across Ireland as well, and widen their perspective as a congregation in terms of supporting mission throughout the whole of the island. And again, practically, what I've tried to do, what we've done in Ballygale, is just facilitate dialogue between different stakeholders, you know, to that extent. So maybe Stormont government or wider government interests, you know, trying to maybe get police to talk to young people, engaging grassroots community groups, allowing our church to be a place where meetings take place, or maybe even interview people or promote book reviews, that kind of thing, promote debate. I've done all those kinds of things over the last 15 and a half years, and my congregation have been in support of it.
Thanks, Marty. And Jack, you mentioned that you're studying at the minute, and your dissertation has been looking at the overlooked role of churches in reconciliation. So as someone who was born after the agreement was signed, why is that something that's of interest to you, and what sort of things have you been discovering in your research?
Yeah, so I think the story of that all sort of goes back to a conversation I was having with Marty at the time, where we just got talking about the work that Marty's just mentioned, hearing that actually all this reconciliation work was going on in Ballycale. And from there, I began to wonder, actually, if this is the case in one church, is this reconciliation work happening in other places too? So from there, I began to get talking to other Presbyterian ministers, began to hear some of their stories and how actually the church had played such a large role in reconciliation at a community level. And from there, began to look at what the academic literature was saying, and what it tended to say was actually that the church had failed and that the church did not do enough. And I think, as we all know, that it would have sort of argued that the church fell massively short and a lot of the times was to blame for the troubles that was seen within Northern Ireland. So yeah, from there, began to actually challenge the academic literature, began to look and suggest that, yes, okay, maybe the church did fail as an institution, but there is a lot of this work that has gone on at a local level that has been massively overlooked. And a lot of the time that individual churches have worked within their communities and have often done really, really amazing work that hasn't been acknowledged by the literature or by the press.
And I suppose, kind of thinking about all this 25th anniversary stuff, Jack, what do you think that means for like your generation? Do you think people are aware of it? Do you think they care about it? Do they care more about things like climate change than peace and reconciliation? What's your sense of that?
I think actually our generation, if you were to ask most people, we'd probably say that they care more about social issues and climate change than necessarily the questions of old. But actually, that in itself is a massive privilege. And it's only been because of the Good Friday Agreement and because we've lived and we're getting close to 25 years of reasonable peace that actually our generation are able to look at the other issues in society, that we're able to look at the other big questions, those of social issues, the controversial questions within politics today. And we're able to very much move on from the questions that did plague the generations before us.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, because that is settled in some ways, and obviously totally then there's an opportunity to move on and think about other things. Tony, for some people, the agreement was difficult. And how do we balance that tension between recognising, as Jack has said, that created a circumstance where other things can be thought about, but at the same time, has maybe been difficult for victims and survivors or, yeah, people like that?
It was difficult for everybody at the time. I found, looking at that Bible study way back 25 years ago, we were trying to tease out some of those tensions. I keep thinking about Psalm 85, how justice, peace, truth and mercy all embrace each other. And to some extent, the Good Friday Agreement wasn't completely just. I mean, it was very difficult for not only victims, survivors, but for anybody working with security forces to see prisoners released. At the same time, you can't have perfect justice. And there was a balance between perfect justice and peace. And as Christians, we would believe there's only one person who holds together in perfect harmony, justice, peace, truth, and mercy, and that's Jesus Christ. But it was difficult, very difficult for those who were speaking on behalf of the church at the time to try to balance those, put forward biblical material to help people know what to vote. And it was inevitable that there would be different perspectives on that at that time.
And Marty, in your context in which you minister, what's the sense and the feeling 25 years on?
That's a really good question. I think the sense and feeling is one of pessimism. Yeah, there was a reluctance to vote yes if people did vote yes for the agreement. Probably, I wasn't here at the time, but lots of people probably voted no. I don't know. I suspect that might be the case. I mean, for me personally, you know, we haven't had violence for a substantial level of time now in the manner in which we did have violence. We also have had substantial investment, you know, yards away from where I'm sitting, there was substantial European Union investment in social economy projects, sporting projects, Department of Social Development at the time, huge investment in this area, education investment. Our area has gone from being one of the 10 poorest wards in Northern Ireland to being, you know, slowly better. And literacy, numeracy rates have improved in the school. And, you know, we've had a greater period of stability. And a lot of that has been because for a season there was joined up thinking. It's very easy to be cynical about our politicians and people involved in the process at the time. But subsequent to the Good Friday Agreement, you know, people did to an extent get their act together, and change was tangible and manifest in areas like mine. On the other hand, I think obviously, like a lot of working class unionist areas, loyalist areas, whatever people want to call them, there has been a lack of genuine, I think, dialogue and leadership and courage in terms of just asking questions about change and equipping and adapting people for change, which is inevitable in any society. And I think that that's lamentable because we face huge challenges. I mean, when I was in college, it's a slightly long-winded answer to your question, but I think this is really important. When I was in college, we brought in ministers who'd ministered during the Troubles, and they talked to us about the pain that they had to bear, and people had been murdered by the IRA, and they'd ministered to families in those contexts. And we were, I think, a student's probably shocked. When I think now about what I've done in terms of mental health, you know, I've buried multiple suicide victims, multiple. And it's, you know, one year I've heard me say, but it's true, we buried 7 young people one year and under the age between 12 and 32. So, you know, we have real problems. And the quicker we get a health minister installed and up and running and a Stormont executive running again, you know, the better. I had Robin Swan sitting in this study with me, asking me questions when he was health minister. What can we do? Robin Swan actually sat here and asked me, how can we help? And communities like mine really do need help. And we do need a functioning executive. And I hope that we will see one soon.
Tony, what are some of the initiatives that PCI has been involved in over the past number of years around this sort of area? And what challenges do you think remain for the church?
Well, the first one was Considering Grace, which was a book written about Presbyterians and the Troubles. So over 100 people were interviewed, and we tried to be honest. I suppose we were thinking that each community is trying to talk about its past. Let's be accountable. So Gladys Ganiel from Queen's University wrote the book with Jimmy Johannes. That has been very effective, very well received. It's been a model for other churches and faith communities as well. Then there was the 100th anniversary of Northern Ireland, and the first parliament actually met in our college. So we had a major event in the college, which we invited most of the leading politicians along. We had over 100 people, even during lockdown, between the library where the parliament met and the chapel where the Synod met. And the moderator was able to speak to that at the time, David Bruce. So I think that was a very effective outreach, an opportunity to speak into the present situation. Then we followed that up with a series on these steps, going out to different areas, including Ballykeel, down to Monaghan, speaking to young adults, looking at how these questions affect our whole church policy as well. So, yeah, that's the sort of things we've been doing over the last few years.
What sort of challenges do you think remain for the church, and what sort of things sort of coming out from that do you think that we need to be thinking about in the next few years?
I think some of the things Marty has mentioned very eloquently there are still on the agenda. I think one of the things that has changed is that for Presbyterians particularly, we're very aware that we're more of a minority than we were. And how do we live biblically, faithfully as a minority is a particular challenge. And that is probably more so in the west of the province at the moment. I think it does. Separate communities tend to breed separate memories. And there's a real need to try to empathize across community. We have shared our stories of real pain and hurt in considering grace. But I'm very aware that there are other communities that also shared pain. Now, that pain can keep us apart, but it also actually can bring us together as well as we share those stories. So I think that's a particular challenge as well. And to be able to hear stories from different perspectives, it is a challenge. It's a challenge emotionally. And it's a challenge to our Christian faith as well to be able to maintain our ears open to what others are saying.
Jack, Tony just talked there about this kind of acknowledgement that as Presbyterians, we're becoming more of a minority in society. Just wondering how, you know, in your course and in politics, international relations, as a young person, how you find that, how you navigate sort of thing that's very different to what a previous generation has maybe experienced and had to consider?
Yeah, it's. I think it's definitely been interesting. Obviously, within my course, I would be quite a massive minority, but I think probably the most interesting thing that I've discovered is the connotations around the term evangelical Christian. Obviously, with the politics that we're seeing within the States, often this term evangelical just means you're a member of someone who's on the far right of politics, or maybe not far right, but certainly on the right anyway. And often whenever I get into conversations and or even talk in class and say, oh, my politics is largely based on my faith, it's based on my identity as a Presbyterian, as a Christian. And then obviously going further into that, eventually I have to use the term evangelical. And as soon as I mention it, everyone I talk to presumes, oh, this guy must be so far right. This guy loves Trump. And without going too much into my own opinions, but that really couldn't be further from the truth. But my politics is entirely based on this social gospel idea that Jesus cared about the poor, he cared about those in poverty. And actually, it's a real challenge, and it's a really, really interesting place to be a Christian and to ultimately tackle a lot of the big issues in society today.
Thanks, Jack. And Marty, you mentioned that you're a politics graduate as well. Would you say any of your views have changed over the past 25 years or developed in any way since your time studying?
Oh, great question. Yeah, probably. You know, I think when I did study politics in 1993, I started in Jordanstown. It was a really interesting place to study politics. And I just thought, well, I knew I came from one particular point of view and one particular background, but I'll just keep my mouth shut and just listen to other people. And I feel probably now, 25 years after the agreement, reflecting on figures and individuals. One thing I appreciate, which I didn't at the time, was the extent to which John Hume is really the shaper and architect of much of what we consider to be fundamental in terms of the agreement. You know, it really is interesting because the language he used at the time, which is actually used by other, well, Sinn Féin and other people, you know, use that language now, and you know, that language of agreement and of cooperation. And it's just interesting how, looking back, I appreciate the extent to which Irish America, Europe, Hume, working with Westminster as well, you know, how he drew all those strands together. And I probably didn't see that as much at the time looking back, but I can see it now. And I'm not saying it necessarily changed my views, but I just began to appreciate the risks that he and other people took to try and stop violence.
Oh, that's great. Tony, you said at the start that you're recently retired. What advice would you give, or what would you like to pass on to maybe ministers at the start or early days of their first charge or in their first call, or somebody who's thinking about ministry in terms of these areas?
I think for somebody certainly in the areas I've ministered in where the troubles were very, very raw, the Mid-Ulster area, County Armagh, you really do need to understand those who have been victims. They have suffered particularly, and they do that experience needs to be entered into again. They also tend to be very helpful people in terms of their whole community as well, but they do need extra pastoral attention. I think the second thing I say is that as a minister, you're not just called, if you like, to pastor to your people, but you're called into that community and to be salt and light in that community. So to build up relationships beyond your own congregation. Now, Marty's done that really well in Ballykeel, but that often involves stepping across the usual lines. And churches do that is difficult because just your whole community is your church and it can become the only community. But your people have to live in a broader community and you as a minister have to try to reach out into that community. And if you're not intentional, it probably won't happen. So it does involve knocking a few doors, getting to know local politicians, getting to know those from other faith communities. And that should not require any compromise of your own particular views. But in fact, it's because of your own particular biblical views that you should be reaching out.
Marty, do you have any other kind of tips or advice in terms of starting to build those relationships within a local community?
I agree with everything Tony's just said. I mean, I think I always came into the situation of Ballykeel knowing it was, in the heart of a loyalist estate and believing that it was really important not to criticise my own people, but just to listen to them and try and understand where they come from. And there was a very experienced minister working in a very troubled part of North Belfast years ago who gave me a piece of advice. He says, never criticise your own people publicly. And I thought that was excellent advice, and I would never criticise, the groups and individuals I work with here, but equally I would prepare them for any dialogue I would have with people from other communities and explain to them why I'm doing that. And I would always do it away from publicity and away from party politics and just try and build that cobweb and network of relationships over a long period of time, lovingly, for the sake of the gospel and love of neighbour.
Jack, obviously a lot of the focus has been on the 25th anniversary of the agreement. What would your vision be for the next 25 years? So whenever the 50th anniversary comes along, what would you love people to be saying or reflecting back on then?
I think for the next 25 years, I would just love to see North Ireland deal with the issues that we're dealing with currently. I think as Christians, ultimately, what we believe is that identity is so, so important. And often I think, yes, we've made incredible strides in the last 25 years dealing with the idea of identity and largely that the group of people who would have identified as a radical Republican or a radical loyalist 25 years ago has massively reduced in number to what it would be today. But I think at the same time, we need to acknowledge that today there is still a significant group of people who tie to that identity as a radical Republican, as a radical loyalist. And I think within the next 25 years, what I would love to see is Northern Ireland actually deal with this question of identity and deal with those who are still tied to it. And ultimately, as Christians, what we believe is the perfect identity is the identity in Jesus. I would love to see our government, I would love to see us deal with actually this small group in society and actually really be able to provide good economic opportunities, good jobs, good careers, and really be able to work and eliminating the poverty and the social issues that do exist within North Ireland. Like, it's clear that we are behind the rest of the UK and in so many ways. And I would love to just see in 25 years time in Northern Ireland that is able to look back at the last 25 years and be like, and realize, you know what, we have come a long, long way economically. We've come even further away in 50 years since the Good Friday Agreement. And that, yeah, in 50 years, we're able to look back and see an island that is filled with prosperity, that is filled with people of all walks of life, of all political ideas, of all nationalities, beliefs, just working towards a future of a good, prosperous Northern Ireland.
Thanks, Jack. One of the things that we ask our contributors to the podcast today is to share a verse just as we finish. So I was wondering, Tony, if I could start with you, is there a particular verse that you'd like to share in relation to this conversation?
Yeah, perhaps this is just from Psalm 85, and it fits in with what Jack has said. The first verse, you showed favour to your land, O Lord, you restored the fortunes of Jacob, you forgave the iniquity of your people and covered all their sins. You set aside all your wrath and turned from your fierce anger.
Great. Marty?
I love that verse. And I'm really challenged by Luke 23:34, where Jesus on the cross said, "Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do." Martin Luther has a quote. He says, "Jesus wept over his enemies because they would have no part in the great benefit to be derived from his death. Yet he prayed for their sin." And in the face of this, we are ready to snarl and growl over the least trifle when asked to yield even a little to our neighbor. Here you see how far we are still from Christ.
Thanks. And what about you, Jack?
Yeah, I think for me, just 2 Corinthians 18 and 19 is what really stands out to me. All this is from God, who reconciled us to himself through Christ and gave us the ministry of reconciliation. That God was reconciling the world to himself in Christ, not counting people's sins against them, and he has committed to us the message of reconciliation. So just this idea that as we were reconciled to Christ, we should work hard to reconcile ourselves to each other.
Brilliant. Thank you. So I think that's all we have time for this episode. So a big thanks to Jack and to Marty and to Tony for some really interesting reflections. For us in PCI as a denomination and as congregations and as individuals, if you'd like to find out more about considering grace that Tony spoke about, or even our vision for society statement, you can get more information on the PCI website. Before we finish, don't forget you can keep up to date with everything that's going on in the life of our denomination via our PCI social media channels on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. So that's all for this episode. We hope you'll join us again next time, and until then, thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Presbyterian Church in Ireland. Thanks for joining us.